I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday afternoon. Harold Holzer has written another superb book on Abraham Lincoln. It's titled Lincoln and the Power of the Press, The War for Public Opinion. Harold Holzer is a leading authority on Lincoln and the Civil War, chair of the Abraham Lincoln Bicentennial Foundation. He is a Roger Hertog Fellow at the New York Historical Society, author of Lincoln at Cooper Union, the speech that made Abraham Lincoln president, and Lincoln President-elect, Abraham Lincoln and the Great Secession Winter, 1860 to 1861. He's been awarded the National Humanities Medal, and the book looks at so many issues. It looks at the role of newspapers at this time in history, this important time in history, the interdependence between the press and politics, which was actually fairly toxic. It looks at Abraham Lincoln, the politician, and how he used the press. And I've always been really interested in censorship or putting some editors in jail, closing down some newspapers because you figured you might lose the war if that didn't happen. So we'll talk about that part of Lincoln's presidency as well, and more. It's a big book, and Abraham Lincoln was a big subject. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Harold Holzer, thank you for being with us once again. Hello.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and thanks for the kind words about the book.
Yeah, it's great, as you are. Well, let's go back to 1858. I love these stories about him, because I didn't know this, that you write about his going to visit, you know, knocking on the door to see the editor of the Central Illinois Gazette. You know, they're trying to do their jobs, but Abe knows what he's doing, and he's just trying to get to know everybody so they'll like him, right?
Like him and support him. Every town had a Republican paper and a Democratic paper in Wisconsin or Illinois or Indiana or Ohio, and Lincoln was determined that he become the favorite of the Western editors. So whenever he was in town on a law case or giving a speech, he would make sure to meet the editor. And in the case that you're talking about, the editor was busy typesetting upstairs, which was a pretty sloppy job in those days with ink and type that had been used and was dirty, and he said, oh, that guy is downstairs. I will go see him, but I'm not going to roll down my sleeves. And that guy became his lifelong friend. He became one of his White House secretaries, biographer. He lived until 1900 and wrote 100 books.
Oh, my goodness.
Many about Abraham Lincoln.
Mm. So obviously, Abraham Lincoln knew the power of the press and how it could serve him in his political ambition, right?
Absolutely. It was the only means of communication. It had rapidly been revolutionizing with the introduction of the telegraph and with new printing presses that could roll off so many tens of thousands of copies in the New York, in the basements of the New York dailies. And yeah, they were powerful. And of course, as you mentioned in the intro, completely allied with political parties. Mm-hmm. They weren't dispassionately covering politics. They were of, by, and for the politicians, depending on their affiliation.
And what's fascinating, too, is that you're looking at, you start the book in Springfield, Illinois, in the 1850s. So you've got this really politically active group of people who live there. You've got Abraham Lincoln and you've got Stephen Douglas,
yeah,
too. So, of course, you've got newspapers and pamphlets and people talking about politics. It must have been quite some time.
It was the new state capital. You know, in the 1830s, Lincoln had helped make it the state capital. Douglas was there. Lincoln was there even earlier than the 50s. And it was so toxic that that one day Stephen Douglas went up to the editor of the Whig paper, you know, the party that preceded the Republicans, Lincoln's paper, and picked a fight with him in the street. And they rolled around in Springfield's notorious mud.
Oh,
before they were separated. I mean, nobody would challenge Lincoln to a wrestling match because he was already well known as a, you know, legendary New Salem wrestler, so nobody was going to pick on him. But these two guys, who were not in the best of shape, as we would say today, had to be pried apart by Democrats and Whigs. And it was common. The Lincoln's hometown editor was in a number of brawls and duels. He once tried to strike Lincoln's successor in Congress with a mallet. He was fined for being violent. So absolutely I mean, just I invite people, not in the book because it's a little obvious, but when I do talks across the country, just imagine, you know, Rachel Maddow getting into a fight with I don't know, Ted Cruz,
right,
with cowhide whips, which was another favorite weapon, or, you know, Bill O'Reilly brawling with Hillary. So, you know, it doesn't happen anymore, but it was pretty common then.
Oh, Harold, you just suggested it, and think what it would do for the ratings.
It would be great for the ratings. It would get everybody, everybody would get all of their hostility off their chest. And, you know, the winners would go on to do the people's bidding. I don't
know. Who knows?
I'm just thinking the images that I created are maybe a little too disturbing.
Yeah, but, boy, they were vivid. I've also heard you talk about the fact that newspapers in Abe were pretty synonymous. Even when he was a fairly young guy, when he was in this log cabin in Kentucky, he was reading newspapers often.
His stepmother testified to that. She read a little bit herself, you know. And by legend, we know that he read the Bible and he read Shakespeare, and we like to think of him sitting by the fireside, absorbing those great, great books and learning them, which, by the way, he did, from primers as well. But he also read the Missouri Democrat, which, despite its name, was a Whig paper.
Mm-hmm.
The Missouri Republican was the Democratic paper. These things got very confusing after a while. But he used to, you know, turn a chair upside down and lie on the back of the seat portion, between the spokes of the legs, and his cousins would describe him reading these big broadsheet newspapers, much larger in size than the broadsheets of today, and he was very absorbed in them. When he was a postmaster in New Salem, I love this story, and a couple of people attested to it. He was the village postmaster, the only job he really could get in this new town he moved to. And as such, he handled a lot of newspapers that came in. People subscribed to the newspapers of the towns they had left in their westward migration. That's the way to keep touch with their hometowns or their origin, towns of origin.
Uh-huh.
And then they started getting their newspapers sort of clumsily refolded.
Ooh,
and
yep.
Lumpy. And I don't know if they were food stained. Lincoln didn't eat much. But somehow they knew. And, you know, they didn't get angry. They thought, this man is something special, and how curious he is, and he's reading every paper, and sort of beat a path to the post office to watch him in action.
And writing to the papers, too, occasionally, right?
Even as a teenager,
yeah.
We now know he wrote one editorial on temperance, which a neighbor helped steer toward a regional paper, and then another one on education, two issues that were very important to him early. He sort of abandoned focus on those issues when he turned his complete attention to slavery in the 1850s. But I think it gave him a really, you know, a heady feeling as a teenager to see his name in print.
Mm-hmm.
And even though later, you know, before he became president, he became more accustomed to signing editorial columns with pen names, because he became quite a creator of anonymous editorials for the press to sort of stir up the Democrats and make them angry.
Hmm. And jumping ahead a bit, but we'll do that in the course of the conversation. You wrote this terrific book about Cooper Union.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize that he stayed up after he gave that speech because it was printed, right, in some papers, and he wanted to make sure that it was absolutely accurate.
You know, yes, absolutely. He gave a 2-hour speech. He listened to more speeches. He was sort of hauled off to a big reception and dinner in his honor at a local club. They put him on a streetcar. They noticed his feet were aching, and he was walking with a limp because of new boots. But he did not go back to his hotel. I can't even imagine. It must have been midnight. He went to the offices of the New York Tribune across the park and proofread two sets, we think, of proofs. Because the House Divided Address, his most famous speech previous to Cooper Union, had been mistypeset with some paragraphs interposed, and he didn't want that to happen again. The only sad thing is that by tradition, in those days, when the typeset copy was correct, you sort of tossed your manuscript to the floor to be swept away with the trash. And in those days, Lincoln did not have a clerk or an aide. He went to New York all by his lonesome self, and so we don't have the manuscript. It's unless some brilliant typesetter picked it up 150 years ago and it's hidden in some family trunk, it's gone forever, because all he cared about, even more than the speech, which 1,500 people heard, that was pretty good for him, is what happened, what people saw the next morning, 150,000 people saw.
Right, exactly. If somebody had only saved that manuscript, it's nobody knew.
I know. Nobody knew. He didn't care. He only cared about the next day. You know, he was not an archivist in his heart. He didn't care about collectibles or his own material, and that's why it's so good that once he became a candidate for president, his friends told him, take this guy who works in the state capitol where your office is now. He works for the state secretary of state, and he doesn't have enough to do. He'd be great for you. And he was a newspaper editor, so Lincoln took him.
What did he do? Because yesterday was the anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. What did he do with the Gettysburg Address? Was that printed?
It was, but he wasn't as smart about it as the man who gave the principal oration that day. I was in Gettysburg yesterday.
Oh, were you really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, I'm there every November 19th.
We have
a group called the Lincoln Forum,
thelincolnforum.org,
if I can put in a plug,
Sure. Which
meets every year. We get about 300 people. We talk about, right now we're locked into a very exciting 150th anniversary commemoration.
Right.
So we talked about 1864. This year, but then we head over to the cemetery, which sounds doer, but 9 degrees wind chill factor this year, and we watch a speaker, and we watch this wonderful actor named James Getty, who for years has read the words. He looks like Lincoln. He dresses like Lincoln. But back to your question. So Edward Everett, who was invited to give the principal address, had his two-hour, I don't even know how many words, 20,000-word speech, typeset in advance and sent to the leading newspapers of the day. So they all got it ready in type, and they put it in as the leader for the front pages the next day. Lincoln's 272 words were not completed until the night before, and when he read them, an Associated Press stringer was in the front row taking it down, couldn't get it all down, and relied on Lincoln's manuscript. He borrowed it for a few minutes to check it against his transcription. One of the editors in the front row said, when Lincoln sat down after 2.5 minutes, he said, "Is that all?" And Lincoln was sort of annoyed, looked back at him and said, "Yes, for the moment." So in the end, although obviously it became much more famous than the Everett Address, the Gettysburg Address was printed in the lower right-hand corner of most pages. You know, I call it the biggest Lincoln story that the press missed in the entire Civil War. But, you know, editorials came soon after, and as always, people think the Gettysburg Address is sacrosanct and, you know, American political gospel, which it is. But the editorial response was, as always, as had been for his entire career, strictly partisan. The Democratic press thought it was an embarrassment to the dead, and the Republican press thought it was a brilliant speech.
Hmm.
So I don't think people of the day could quite figure out its immortality.
What an endlessly fascinating man. All right, let's talk about these newspaper editors and this real, you know, it's a pretty toxic thing we got going on here. You just mentioned that he hired somebody for an administrative position. I hadn't realized how many friends of newspaper editors got jobs in Washington.
Oh, newspaper editors themselves got jobs in Washington. And, you know, when Lincoln became president, the joke about the Republican New York Tribune was that so many junior editors had been appointed to diplomatic posts that there was no way to get the paper out.
Oh, my.
But, it was... We don't want to say that it's dishonest Abe now, rewarding people, but it was common practice.
Mm-hmm.
You put your newspaper editor friends in key posts for two reasons. One, you were expected to reward them because they had supported you for months or years. And B, you had good writers in these posts who could make policy and articulate policy in different jobs. So, you know, editors from Wisconsin and Illinois and all over got jobs. One of my favorite characters in the book is a man named John Wayne Forney, F-O-R-N-E-Y. Looks just like Bill Murray, which I find strange every time I see his picture. But he came in to see Lincoln early in the administration, and Lincoln knew who he was. He was a Democrat. He was a Democratic editor of a Philadelphia paper who had worked for the Democratic majority as the clerk of the House of Representatives. Well, now the House was flipping Republican, and Forney came in and said two things. A, I'm starting a paper in Washington, which you might be interested in, and B, I've decided to become a Republican. So Lincoln said, well, he said, what can I do for you? Well, I'd like to have a – I just lost my job as clerk of the House with this new majority. And Lincoln helped him become clerk of the Senate, which was an even better job.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's the job he held, and he became so close to Lincoln that he sort of became the house organ for the administration.
What a story. And I think you broke this story, too. I never knew this, that Lincoln bought a German-language newspaper. Was it in Springfield?
It was. The guy arrived from downstate Illinois, a German-American editor, and wanted to start a paper on his own in the state capital where Lincoln lived, but he must have had enormous debts because the printing presses and the typesetting equipment were seized by some unknown, unnamed creditor. And the editor appealed to Lincoln to help. Lincoln actually had just received a $500 law fee, which he was obligated by his law contract to share with his partner. And he turned to his partner and said, we've just bought a newspaper. What he did was write his own contract. I know lawyers are not supposed to write their own contracts because then they have fools for clients. But he wrote the contract, which stipulated that this editor was to be completely loyal to the Republican platforms of the state and the nation. Mm-hmm. And if he was, for another year and a couple of months, which would have been the end of 1860, the presidential campaign year, then he would give everything to him, the printing press, the type, everything. He didn't want it. He didn't want any profit. He didn't want any fee. This guy could be the editor. And guess what? He was completely loyal. At the end of 1860, he got the printing press back. Lincoln made sure the state legislature bought the last 1,500 copies of the paper at Retail Plus. There's a nifty deal. And he made the guy minister, consul to Vienna.
Oh, my gosh.
A nice payoff at $1,500 a year, which was a lot of money in those days. And that was the way it worked.
Yeah.
We still have the contracts, one in Brown University and one in the state collection in Springfield.
Oh.
We could see in Lincoln's, both of them written in Lincoln's handwriting.
Oh, make me hungry to go back to Springfield, which we hope to do sometime soon. We're going to welcome phone calls. Harold Holzer, and we have so much more to talk about, is our guest this hour. And his latest book is Lincoln and the Power of the Press, The War for Public Opinion. The book also, of course, goes into the censorship. And I want to talk to Harold about this because I find it interesting, jailing, exiling editors who opposed, who may have sympathized with secession or who imposed enlistment. I want to talk to him about whether or not that was necessary and what Lincoln thought about doing that. And we have to talk about the three major editors, too, the major newspapers that are a big part of this story, and Horace Greeley and Henry Raymond and James Gordon Bennett, who were the big ones who came to hate each other, he said, not only personally but politically. But they all wound up embracing Lincoln to various degrees of enthusiasm. We'll talk about their papers as we carry on. So here's our phone number. Join us if you would like. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we are talking about Abraham Lincoln and the press this hour. Harold Holzer is our guest. Lincoln and the Power of the Press is the name of his new book. Harold Holzer, a leading authority on Lincoln and the Civil War, chair of the Abraham Lincoln Bicentennial Foundation, and spent yesterday at Gettysburg. Spends every anniversary of Gettysburg at Gettysburg. All right, let's go to phone calls. Casey in Green Bay. Hi, Casey.
Well, good afternoon. How are you?
All right. How are you?
Oh, awesome. Well, there's a lot of tie-ins to Wisconsin with President Lincoln, too, especially Ripon, Wisconsin, the birthplace of the Republican Party. And hopefully the author was able to celebrate Lieutenant Alonzo Cushing receiving the Medal of Honor 151 years after the fact.
Right.
On the third day of the battle at the Angle in Gettysburg. And also, you know, President Lincoln was very studious, obviously, and he studied. And he studied the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which was a precursor to the Civil War. And he knew what was coming as he grew up as a young man with the Missouri Compromise being finalized in the Senate. And also the newspapers of the day, that was the first time during the Civil War where they actually lampooned the president in public, and both sides, the Confederacy, mercifully crucified him. But the North really hammered him and lampooned him. They made him to look like a monkey many times, or an ape, or the devil, or a very afraid person. And that was one of the very first part of ever the press making fun of the president of the United States in public print. And I will take your response to my answers off the air.
Thank you, Casey.
What a great voice that fellow has. Mm-hmm. That's my first reaction. He could have been on the political stump in the 19th century. I'm envious. But on the subject of lampooning, I think it would be not quite correct to say he was the first. Jackson was lampooned. Van Buren was lampooned. Buchanan, Lincoln's predecessor, was mercifully lampooned. They always showed him with his head like tilted to the left because he had a condition that didn't allow him to get his head straight, exactly straight. I think the reason that we think Lincoln was, you know, unmercifully and to a record-breaking level lampooned is that the technology got better. And the weekly pictorial weeklies were born in the late 1850s, like Harper's Weekly in 1858, Frank Leslie's Illustrated News Service. So part of it was that the ability to reproduce cartoons, not just on sheets that you would hang in your local tavern, but in the very newspapers that came into your home, proliferated. Not to say that he was treated with universal, you know, kindness, but I think the key here is to remember, Republican press was mostly very, very enthusiastic about Lincoln, and the Democratic press was cruel, vicious, just as if the reverse had happened when Buchanan, the Democrat, was president. It was all partisan, not personal.
What about, you have talked about the use of photography so citizens connect with him. Lincoln's understanding of the power of images, he had far more faith, you've said, in the power of words than in the capacity of his homely face. I don't think it was that homely.
I know,
to move.
We don't see the skin, we just see the features.
That's true, but that's true. So what does that mean, that he didn't have a lot of images taken and used of himself in newspapers? He preferred the words, or did he use both?
Oh, I would say that it's a totally separate thing. Photographs could not be reproduced in newspapers at that point. But there was another technological revolution in 1859 and 60, and that is that instead of photographs being single image souvenirs that you took home and put on your own mantle, suddenly they've invented glass negatives and they could be reproduced in quantity by the thousands. So celebrities got their faces known, and Lincoln was ushered into the photo studios in New York City the morning he was scheduled to deliver the Cooper Union address that we were discussing a few minutes ago. And as he later said, that photograph and the Cooper Union address made me president. So many thousands of copies were issued and so many adaptations in prints and in fact in cartoons, pro and con. So that became the reigning image. He went to the photography studios quite often. It's just a separate story from the newspaper story. You know, I'd love to write another Lincoln image book, but that's to come.
Yeah, good. Well, go. Please do. Write a lot of Lincoln books as far as I'm concerned. Here we are. We haven't even talked about Horace Greeley and Henry Raymond and James Gordon Bennett. They were the three big newspaper editors.
Right.
Very different politically, and they take a big part of this book as well. So who were they?
Yeah, and I really wanted it to be a joint biography of those guys and Lincoln. In fact, all of the Republican Democratic editors that he encountered during his career. These were three he didn't really encounter, interestingly. It's just that they were operating in their parallel universe in New York City. And because they're in New York City, their newspapers were spread westward and reprinted, their big stories reprinted. But they also founded national editions that were published all over the country. So they became very powerful, very famous, and big personalities. Bennett was the first. He was sort of a wild man. maybe the Rupert Murdoch of his day, you know, a tabloid type, sensationalistic, a Democrat, a racist, anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic Church.
Nice guy.
But he also was brilliant as a newspaper man. He sort of invented theatrical reviews and stock market reports, newsboys hawking the papers. So that was one that gave Lincoln a lot of trouble over the years. The next guy was Greeley, who founded the New York Tribune in 1841, crusading anti-slavery man, one of the earliest Republican Whig guys to convert to the Republican Party. But he did Lincoln in a few times. He lusted for political office. He never got it. It's amazing how many times you run across stories of editors who wanted basically to be politicians, and politicians like Lincoln who wanted to be newspaper editors. Greeley ran for governor of New York, U.S. senator, lieutenant governor. He served in Congress at the same time as Lincoln, and just didn't pick him out as a future great, interestingly. He had a blind spot where Lincoln was concerned. It was troubling in a way. And in the end, after all his years of advocating for emancipation, pushing Lincoln on it, even as president, with lectures and editorials, he was ready to abandon emancipation during the 1864 election campaign to end the war.
Goodness.
And Lincoln wrote him off after that. And then there's the youngest of the three, Henry Raymond, who worked for Greeley and then decided Greeley was a little too unpredictable with his embrace of kind of faddish causes like vegetarianism, spiritualism, bran cereals, all sorts of loopy kinds of things. And Raymond founded the only one of the three papers that's still in existence, the New York Times. Very straightforward party newspaper. But he wasn't for Lincoln in 1860. He was for William Seward and went to the convention and supported Seward, but became a loyal Republican, went off the reservation a few times like all editors did. But think of this, 150 years ago, he was celebrating Lincoln's reelection even as at this time of year, not just because he supported Lincoln editorially and ran the Times, which he did, but because he also served as chairman of the Republican National Committee.
Wow.
Can you imagine that
Goodness
happening today?
Goodness gracious. Can you imagine that? But they all came to, even this guy you described in not
Bennett.
Very flattering terms, Bennett, were supportive of the Union efforts.
Yeah, Bennett was supportive of the Union. He became supportive of the Union, especially when a mob surrounded his paper when he refused to fly an American flag after the American flag had been fired on at Fort Sumter. But then he volunteered a yacht for the Union Naval Service. He volunteered his son to be a naval officer. And he supported the Union. He just didn't support emancipation and was very hostile about black recruitment and the draft. So, you know, not a Lincoln supporter by any means, although Lincoln worked really hard to get him sort of neutralized during the war because he was so powerful.
Well, let's talk about it because I find this a fascinating part of history. Well, the whole time is, but the censorship issue. How many papers were there, Harold, that were disloyal? What role did the president have in closing those down, in jailing some of the editors? How widespread was that? And was there legitimate controversy about whether or not this was censorship? Do you think this had to be done?
Well, so start with the statistics. Nobody has a real firm knowledge of the number. My guess is if you can conclude those whose editors were indicted by grand juries, which happened in a few cities, the number is probably pushing 200. There are famous cases that everybody knows about, General Burnside angrily shutting down the Democratic Chicago Times and getting reversed by Lincoln. Lincoln himself signing an order shutting down the New York World and the New York Journal of Commerce, two Democratic papers, and ordering the editors to be imprisoned. So it was happening, beginning with the Sumter crisis, certainly after Bull Run. But as soon as Lincoln called for volunteers in April 1861, the newspapers that said, don't fight to save the Union, don't enlist, those were the papers who were at risk at the beginning. They were all Democratic papers. And the constitutional scholars, Lincoln scholars, and political science professors have been arguing this in in retrospect for the last 155 years. Was there justification? And constitutionally, I think Lincoln made a pretty good case that, you know, the writ of habeas corpus can be suspended during a time of rebellion, as the Constitution lays out. Whether he could do it without the Congress or not is another issue. It's sort of a debatable issue.
Mm-hmm.
Was the threat existential? Would these newspapers have caused the destruction of the government? Probably not. But Lincoln, you know, was trying to figure out with his generals where to draw this line in the sand between dissent and treason. Mm-hmm. And you ask whether people objected. Yeah, the Democratic press objected strenuously. And if they objected too strenuously, then they were suppressed, and their editors were arrested if they call Lincoln a tyrant.
Mm-hmm.
But what's astonishing to me is, you know, if you consider the fraternity of the press and the, you know, once you get past politics, the press considers itself an estate of society that is sort of independent and must be independent. The Republican editors, including Raymond and Greeley and Joseph Medill in Chicago, all the leading Republican editors said, freedom of the press is not guaranteed in times of a crisis like this.
Mm-hmm.
Loyalty is more important. It trumps civil liberties here.
Mm-hmm.
So the Republic, again, everything partisan, even reaction to suppression.
What do you think?
I mean, I think the Union would have survived without imprisoning the editors,
mm-hmm.
but I think that's, with the benefit of hindsight, I don't think Lincoln had any way to know that. And I give him enormous credit for two things during this crisis. One is that during the two big election campaigns of the Civil War era, the 1862 off-year elections and his own presidential election, he was completely tolerant of a free and, you know, grousing and grumbling and abusive press. The gentleman who called said that the press was abusive. The same paper he shut down in the summer of 1864 was attacking him viciously by the fall of 1864. He thought that political campaigns were such a sacred part of American democracy. As he put it, if the presidential election didn't go on as scheduled, then the rebels could claim that they've already defeated democracy.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the point of this whole thing?
Mm-hmm.
So I give him credit for that, tolerating that kind of dissent and being prepared to lose. The editor of the New York Times, chairman of the RNC, Henry Raymond, wrote him a letter in late August 1864 and said, you're going to lose. Everyone knows you're going to lose. Maybe you should put the Emancipation Proclamation back up, back on the table. And Lincoln called him to Washington and said, you know, I think it's better in this one to lose than to rescind the proclamation.
Hmm.
As he put it later, I should be damned in time and eternity if I did that. So campaigns went on, attacks went on during campaigns. And then the second thing is in 61, when the war starts and newspapers are being shut down or suppressed or not shipped by the post office, by Union Army is throwing papers off trains and editors are being arrested in Maryland and Missouri and Kentucky, the border states. I think that was a moment when a more repressive and dictatorial leader might have imposed, you know, Izvestia or TASS. That was the moment when we could have had no free press, and it could have been completely destroyed in America, and maybe a large number of people wouldn't have minded. We would have had a national government news service, period. And he resisted that impulse, too.
Hmm.
And for that, I think he deserves credit. You can't really give people reverse credit for not doing something,
mm-hmm.
but I try to do it in the book.
Hmm. Let's go to Eugene and Viola next. Hi, Eugene.
Good afternoon, Kathleen. There was a African American unit that marched in Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural parade in 1865. I'm wondering, was that controversial? Whose idea was it? And was there any repercussions in the Northern press? And I'll take my answer off the air.
It's a great question. I wish I knew the precise answer. There was always controversy when African American units marched, even at the end of the Civil War, when every victorious unit marched down Pennsylvania Avenue. Lincoln was dead at the time, in May 1865. African-American units were relegated to the rear, and the parade had been over, and it were not given the respect at all that they deserved. In New York City, I'm not proud to report, a black contingent was denied the right to march in Lincoln's funeral by New York City authorities, who were largely Democrats. And Secretary of War Stanton overruled them and said they must march in the Lincoln funeral. I don't know if he had the power to enforce it, but he was pretty tough and feared. And the New York City officials got even by having them march so far to the back that by the time they reached the ferry station in the West 30s in Manhattan, where Lincoln's body was to be shipped, in fact, his body had already left by boat and was up by West Point, they say, by the time the black contingent got to the dock. So always resistant, always racist resistance. And the inaugural parade in those days preceded the inauguration. It was reverse order of now. Parade first, inaugural address second, and swearing in third. It's exactly the opposite of what we do. But I will say, I know I'm taking a long time here, but the final answer is the crowd at the Capitol grounds, on the other side of the Capitol in those days, and we do it now since the Reagan era, I always forget if it's the West Front or the East Front, but it's the back, where the Visitor Center is now. That was the first mixed-race crowd that had ever witnessed a presidential inauguration.
Huh. Isn't that fascinating? And while we're talking, let's talk about Frederick Douglass for a moment. He had a newspaper as well. Who read his newspaper, and did Lincoln read his newspaper?
Frederick Douglass had several newspapers, the North Star and eventually Douglass's Monthly, very influential. Something of a curiosity in the early days, Douglass used to, at least wrote in his autobiography, that in the early days, white tourists who went to Niagara Falls would make a diversionary train trip to Rochester, New York, to see him writing and typesetting because they thought that he was a front. He was an invention. A black person could not write editorials or even learn the rudiments of printing. You know, one of the reasons the Southern... This is a diversion again, but one of the reasons, and I don't think I even wrote this in my book, it was dumb, stupid of me. One of the reasons the Southern press vanished during the Civil War, I wrote the main reasons. There was no paper, there were no printing, there were no experts, they were all drafted, but I should have made the point. If they had trained African Americans to be journalists, not journalists, but just typesetters, if they had permitted African Americans to read, then the Southern press might have lived. So, ironically, their brutality about learning. Frederick Douglass was taught by a white master to read, and of course, was with Lincoln, two of the most gifted writers of the 19th century. So he had this newspaper. Did Lincoln? It was read by literate African Americans, freemen, and also by abolitionists. Didn't really go beyond, but whenever James Gordon Bennett caught wind of an editorial, he would lash out at the audacity of this colored man writing these outrageous things about this country. He talked once about right making might, and I don't know if Lincoln read the paper, but it sure was eerily like the peroration of the Cooper Union. So, in those days, I would say being accused of reading Douglass's Monthly would have been disqualified from running for president. It was that considered that radical.
Really?
Yep.
Wow. More phone calls in a moment. This hour we're talking with Harold Holzer, who's written yet another wonderful book about Abraham Lincoln. This one is Lincoln and the Power of the Press, The War for Public Opinion. Harold is a leading authority on President Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. He is chair of the Abraham Lincoln Bicentennial Foundation. He's a fellow at the New York Historical Society. He wrote Lincoln at Cooper Union, and he has won the National Humanities Medal. So here's our number. Join us if you'd like in the minutes that remain. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Harold Holzer is our guest this hour. We go to Marcus in Green Bay next. Hi, Marcus.
Hi. Didn't I read somewhere, maybe even your guest wrote something about it, that Lincoln was so savvy about how the press worked, the printed press, in the form of the many pamphlets and, of course, newspapers, that he, in a way, could almost be looked at as a precursor to the way social media is used, where he could put things out there almost in the form of a comment and then read all these other articles and papers and pamphlets and get feedback and then use that to his advantage and to push his cause and to get people fired up about his initial thought or something like that. The guest comment on that?
Yeah, you have commented on that, Harold. He would have been great in this age.
Yeah, I think the caller is absolutely right. This is the 19th century, you know, precursor of the social media, because Lincoln is using the press in a way that nobody had ever used before, no leader had ever used it before. In the early 19th century, the administration would designate an official newspaper, usually a creaky old newspaper in Washington. The dispatches, the official notices of the government would be slowly, you know, horseback driven over to the paper. They would be published in the next week. Eventually, they'd be mailed across the country so that little newspapers would carry them. In return, the paper got government printing contracts. Actually, the Congress before Lincoln came in reformed that. No more. They established a government printing office. So newspapers had to really look for news now. They weren't just getting, although they still got some advertising and printing, but not the way they had before with all official records. Lincoln figured out a way to reach millions of Americans, and there were a few million in those days, by writing letters to editors. We call them public letters. I wish I could think of a cleverer name for them, because they were more. They had the force of, you know, just a tweet to the millions, I guess. And these letters would be on major issues, usually about presidential power or emancipation or black recruitment. But not content with just sending them to the recipients to whom they were addressed, Lincoln would also give them to other newspapers. In one case, with Horace Greeley, probably the most famous letter to the editor in history, in which he said he would only emancipate the slaves if it would save the Union. He was sort of setting up the public not to think he was too pro-African-American, because he'd already written the proclamation when he sent the letter. Hmm. When he did that, he sent it to Greeley, but he gave it to a Washington paper on a Friday. It was published first in Washington on Saturday, and then he really stuck it to Greeley because Greeley didn't publish on the Sabbath. So other papers did it Saturday and Sunday, and Greeley had to wait until Monday. That was his punishment for being a little too fractious. So here he is using these letters to get his message across in a way that it was breathtaking for Americans to read an open letter from the president on the pages of their local paper.
Hmm.
Written in, by the way, and this is important, written in language that they could understand, mm-hmm. not highfalutin, purple prose, but in a way that was designed for everyday Americans. You know, he wrote one of his first major messages was on, it was July 4th, 1861, was on why we're fighting this war, why we need recruits, why I have to exercise presidential power. And he said, you know, you've heard about this rebellion, but the people who talk about the rebellion are lying about why they're doing it. It's not about states' rights. It's not about my power. It's about slavery and hating the Union, and they've been sugarcoating things. And the U.S. printer came to Lincoln, and he was a former newspaper editor from Indiana, and he said, sugarcoated? You can't say sugarcoated in a presidential letter and a proclamation. And Lincoln said, oh, this is my friend Forney, who I talked about before, the guy who looks like Bill Murray.
Oh.
Says to him, Forney, the day will never come when the plain people in this country don't know what sugar-coated means. Leave it the way it is.
Oh, great.
And that's why he was so successful at this kind.
Isn't it?
19th century social media. I love it.
Yeah. And it was interesting earlier when you said that he was probably one of the better writers of that whole century.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that dumbfounding from this guy who just never really went to school? It never ceases to amaze me. He did it all himself.
And, you know, people ask me how is it possible? How is it possible with Mark Twain, who's revolutionizing literature the way Lincoln is revolutionizing political literature? I don't know. You know, it makes you think that there is a divinity because
how does
this child have no advantages, no encouragement from his father, a stepmother at least who brings a couple of books and a chair into the house, and from that becomes a writer that professional writers say was among the greatest of the 19th century. It's just a miracle.
Yeah, it is. Thank you, Marcus, for your call. Ron in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hey, yes. The parallels that your book, the title of your book could be applied to today, Obama and the war, or the opposition of the media, with Fox News and the takeover and the money put into advertising opposing Obama and the recent sweep of the Republicans. And I wonder if you could comment on the parallels between the times, and have we evolved from a white liberator to a black emancipator of immigrants?
There are a lot of parallels there. Tonight, I guess you're right. There's going to be a very controversial presidential proclamation that's going to be covered by the liberal and the conservative press and torn apart and analyzed and parsed, challenged in the courts, challenged by Congress, very much like the Emancipation Proclamation was. It's going to be interesting to see how it rolls out, whether the court takes it up, et cetera, et cetera. But that, you don't need me to comment on that. On the parallels on press coverage, you know, I think, of course, they're very similar. I think what's different now is that we've become accustomed to an ethos of nonpartisan coverage. We think that that's the way it should be. And so none of the major media on radio or television that has a perceived political, I wouldn't say even bias, but orientation, doesn't declare it. They declare that they simply wise and see things in a certain way, but they would never say we are allied with the Democratic Party or we are beholden and connected to the Republican Party. So we expect nonpartisanship. In Lincoln's day, these attacks, you know, energized the opposition, but they angered the loyalists, but they were expected. You were a Republican commentator or a Democratic commentator, and you didn't hide it. And I don't know. Here's the difference. In 1860 and 64, this election I've repeatedly said was 150 years ago. We just celebrated the sesquicentennial. 80% of eligible voters voted in 1860 and 1864.
Did they really?
I mean, I know it's only white males, but it's still 80%.
Huh.
And I can't even bring myself to speak the number that voted in the off years. What is it, 32, 31?
36.9.
36, yeah. So maybe if we weren't pussyfooting around political orientation, I don't know, maybe it would
maybe.
Be helped by 5%. That would help a little bit, 10%,
yeah.
Just so we really know what people think.
Yeah, it should be much higher than it is. David, our last caller in Eastman. Hi, David.
Hi. Great show. I'm reading the memoirs of Keir Salinger, JFK's press secretary, and there's a fascinating chapter in there about the crisis in Cuba and how Keir Salinger was very, very prepared along, and he called in all the people from the Post and the Times to impose a wartime censorship if the Cuban Missile Crisis got hot.
We have about 30 seconds, Harold.
Took a page out of Lincoln's book, except that Lincoln mostly did it himself because he didn't have a Pierre Salinger.
No, I guess he didn't, did he? Well, thank you so much. What a delight to speak with you. That event that you talked about at Gettysburg, is that open to the public? Or
it is. It is,
it is really?
If they can dress up in their long johns and wear their mufflers, maybe next year it'll be Indian summer as it was when Lincoln did it in 1863.
Oh, I need to go to that.
And it's also live streamed, so people can watch the speakers. And this year, by the way, the speech was dedicated to Alonzo Cushing. We heard that from our first caller.
Oh, how did I miss all of that? It was live streamed.
Darn. From the Gettysburg Foundation. Might still be online.
Oh, good, good. All right. I'll do it over the weekend. Thank you, Harold, so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Harold Holzer, the book is Lincoln and the Power of the Press, The War for Public Opinion. Well, that was fascinating, wasn't it? What I want to say? I want to say thank you to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in Milwaukee.